In discussing happiness, Aristotle uses the Greek word arete, which traditionally is translated as virtue, but it can also be translated as excellence. Given this meaning, then, happiness requires us to exercise certain capacities of the soul excellently over a whole lifetime. Aristotle hasn't clarified just what counts as excellence in the exercise of the soul, but he seems to believe this concept will include and surpass the other concepts of happiness: pleasure, honor, and contemplation. So Aristotle can claim that his account provides a greater degree of self-sufficiency than any of the others. Happiness, according to Aristotle, would include more intrinsic goods, since the realization of his concept will include contemplation, pleasure, and honor. Moreover, in Aristotle's account of happiness, the good life will better meet his conditions of being within our control and hard to take from us. What he calls the activity of the soul, in accordance with virtue, is indeed within our control and hard to take from us. Finally, because the essence of man is rationality, the person who's achieved Aristotle's happiness, as he conceives it, can claim to have fulfilled himself as a human being, exemplifying all that makes us truly human. Aristotle realizes full well that achieving excellence, the good life, requires a healthy body as well as what he calls external goods.
It is clear that happiness needs external goods. It is impossible, or at any rate, it is not easy, to perform noble actions if one lacks what is required. For one does many things, as it were, with instruments, with the aid of friends, wealth, and political power.
This passage underscores three cardinal features of Aristotle's concept of the good life. First, being truly happy is not a matter of any particular feeling. Rather, it's how we actually live, what we do. As we've seen, this must express the virtue of the rational part of the soul. Second, for Aristotle, happiness is largely a matter of luck. To live a good life, you need enough leisure time in youth to develop excellence. Leisure of this sort is usually available only to those born into a wealthy family. But the family we're born into is entirely a matter of luck. So no matter how we might strive for noble actions, poverty can thwart our search for the good life. Finally, Aristotle realizes that no one's ever completely immune to bad luck. Even if we achieve happiness precisely as Aristotle conceives it, there's no guarantee that we will not be struck down by disease or accident. At the heart of Aristotle's concept of happiness is the notion that to be happy, we must be fulfilled as human beings. We saw in his theory of the soul that for this, we must have developed the powers of the soul. In the Nicomachean Ethics, he extends that view, arguing that these powers can be divided into two types: the soul's non-rational powers and the soul's rational powers.
The non-rational part, as well as the soul as a whole, can be thought of as having two parts. One part of the non-rational element shares nothing whatever with reason. The other part, the appetites and desire generally, somehow shares in reason, in the sense that it is commanded by and obeys reason.
Appetites and emotions motivate animals to act. When our appetites and emotions are controlled and directed by our reasoning, Aristotle believes the non-rational part of the soul is in the proper condition. We possess, then, what Aristotle calls the moral virtues. But Aristotle also thinks the rational part of the soul can be divided into two parts:
the one by which we understand those things whose principles are unchangeable, the other by which we understand those things whose principles do not always hold. These two abilities we may call the scientific faculty and the calculative faculty.
Through our scientific faculty, we can come to possess knowledge for its own sake. We can know the unchanging truths of the theoretical disciplines like mathematics, metaphysics, and the natural sciences. But only through the calculative faculty can we understand the activities that lead to the good life. We've attained the virtues of the intellect when we've acquired both knowledge for its own sake and knowledge for the sake of right action. Aristotle would say we've then acquired contemplative virtue and practical wisdom. Most of the Nicomachean Ethics concerns the individual moral virtues and how to attain them. Aristotle emphasizes the virtues of the non-rational part of the soul. So when he says that happiness is the activity of the soul according to virtue, he must mean that happiness consists in part of actions expressing the moral virtues. But we must also remember that he qualifies his definition with an additional phrase.
And if there be more than one virtue, in accordance with the best and most complete virtue.
Aristotle makes it clear throughout the Nicomachean Ethics that he believes contemplative virtue is superior to the other forms of excellence. For example, at one point he says of contemplation,
"This is the activity that is the highest, for the mind is the best part of us, and the objects which the mind knows are the highest objects there are. In addition, we think that pleasure must be mixed in with happiness. But the activity in accordance with knowledge is the most pleasant of the activities in accordance with virtue. What has been called self-sufficiency is most of all to be found in contemplation. The just person needs other persons towards whom to be just. But the contemplative person needs only himself for contemplation."
Clearly, Aristotle believes it's better to be excellent in contemplating eternal philosophical truths than to be superior in performing right actions. It's difficult to reconcile his emphasis here on contemplation over right action, because he says elsewhere that we must have moral virtue to attain the good life. This is one of the basic problems a coherent interpretation of Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics must solve. We'll get back to it later. As in his other attempts to define a key term, Aristotle attempts here to find the genus, or basic category, to which moral virtue belongs. He then isolates its species, the characteristics that distinguish it from other members of the same genus. He arrives at the genus of moral virtue through the following reasoning.
Since there are three kinds of things existing in the soul, emotions, capacities, and habits, moral virtue must be one of these. By emotions, I mean desire, anger, fear, confidence, envy, joy, friendship, hatred, longing, jealousy, pity, and generally those conditions of the soul followed by pleasure and pain. By capacities, I mean that by which we are capable of feeling these things. For example, that by which we are able to be angered, or to feel pain, or to feel pity. Habits are how we stand with respect to the emotions. For example, with respect to being angry, we are not well off if we feel it too little or too much. But if we feel the appropriate amount of anger, we are well off with respect to anger, and similarly with regard to the other emotions. Now, the moral virtues and vices are not emotions, because we are not said to be good or evil on account of our feelings, whereas these judgments are made if we possess either the virtues or vices. For the same reasons, the virtues and vices are not capacities, since we do not say someone is good or bad on account of his capacity to feel an emotion. If the virtues and vices are neither emotions nor capacities, it must be that they are habits.
The moral virtues, then, are habits. But what kind of habits? How can they be distinguished from non-moral habits? To find the moral virtues, Aristotle relies on the notion so often found in Greek literature and philosophy that every successful endeavor expresses an appropriate balance, a mean or middle point between the extremes of either too much or too little.
If every science completes its work well by aiming at the mean and leading the work up to that point, and if the good artisan, as we say, performs his work aiming at this mean, and if every moral virtue is more precise and better than an art, just as nature is, then it must be that moral virtue has the quality of hitting the mean. Now, virtue is concerned with feelings and actions. In both of these, being excessive and deficient are errors, whereas the mean is to be praised and makes for success. And both being praised and being successful are characteristic of moral virtue.
Now, putting the two parts of his definition together, Aristotle defines moral virtue.
Moral virtue is a habit concerning choice, which consists in choosing the mean relative to us, defined by a rational account, such as a man of practical wisdom would give.
When he says that the mean is relative to us, he claims that what is morally appropriate for one man may not be appropriate for another. The abilities, skills, and circumstances of the moral decision maker and of those who will be affected must all be taken into consideration. Thus, for Aristotle, being moral can never be reduced to simply following a basic rule or even a set of rules. Different circumstances can always change things radically. This takes us to a second point. When he says that the mean can be defined by a rational account such as a man of practical wisdom would give, he's claiming that anyone of moral virtue will be able to explain why he chose some particular action. A moral man can explain why particular circumstances made his chosen action the right one. If he's virtuous, his explanation will be the same as that of someone experienced in right action, a wise man. Aristotle thinks, then, that for every human emotion and desire, there's a moderate condition, a deficient condition, and an excessive condition. Each of these can be expressed in actions. Aristotle considers two examples, courage and self-control, and their corresponding vices.
Courage is the mean in feelings of fear and confidence. The source of errors comes about from fearing what one ought not to fear, or from fearing in the wrong way or at the wrong time, and so forth. The courageous person does what he ought and stands fast and fears the right things in the right manner and at the right time. He stands fast and acts so as to express his courage. The one who exceeds in confidence is rash. He that exceeds in fear is a coward, for he fears the wrong things in the wrong manner, and so on. He is deficient in confidence, whose excessive fear, when confronted with painful things, is more obvious.
Unlike the coward and the rash man, the courageous man feels the right amount of fear and acts correctly in response to that fear. Both feeling and acting in appropriate ways, however, are possible for the courageous man only because he recognizes things that are truly dangerous and he understands how dangerous they actually are. Unlike some philosophers who think that all feelings of pleasure are evil, Aristotle thinks that some feelings of pleasure are entirely natural. They contribute to the overall value of our lives. But to find which feelings of pleasure are good and which are not, we must once again apply the doctrine of the mean between extremes. The virtue of self-control allows us to find the mean with respect to pleasure. The vice of self-indulgence surrenders us to excess in pleasure.
Concerning the pleasures of the body, the self-controlled person hits the mean. He does not enjoy what is most pleasant to the self-indulgent person. Rather, he finds them disgraceful. He feels the pleasures of the body no more than he ought, and he does not feel them when it would be wrong. Of the pleasurable things that contribute to his health and well-being, he feels them to a moderate degree and in the way that he should. In so doing, he follows right reason.
The question of how we acquire virtue is as old as Greek philosophy itself. Socrates, for example, thought that virtue can be instilled through teaching. Others thought virtue comes through training and habit. Still others argued that virtue is simply a gift given by the gods to some people, not to others. Aristotle thinks that each of these views is right, but only partly right.
There are two sorts of virtue. Virtue of the intellect and moral virtue. Intellectual virtue, for the most part, has its origin and its development in teaching, and hence it requires experience and time. Moral virtue, on the other hand, is acquired by habit and comes about by nature, for nothing that is acquired by nature can be habituated to be otherwise. Nature gives us the capacity to acquire them, but they are brought forth by habit.
So with proper study and instruction, we can achieve excellence with respect to the intellect. We can contemplate eternal truths about mathematics, God, nature, and man. Through proper habituation, we can achieve excellence in our actions. But what does Aristotle mean by the habituation needed to attain these moral virtues?
We acquire the moral virtues by doing them, just as we do with arts. We learn something by doing the things we shall have to do once we have learned it. For example, by building a house, we become house builders, and by playing the harp, we become harpists. So, by doing just acts, we become just. By acting temperately, we become temperate, and by acting bravely, we become brave. Of course, we must habitually practice achieving the mean between extremes. This, until choosing the mean becomes a habit, ingrained in the soul as though choosing correctly was second nature.
He insists that we can't overestimate the importance of forming habits as early as possible. The moral training we receive during childhood is crucial.
It makes no small difference whether one habit or another is instilled in us right from childhood. In fact, it makes an important difference. Indeed, it makes all the difference.
To see that moral training proceeds as it should, Aristotle says that anyone who oversees the moral development of a child must use pleasure and pain to encourage right action and discourage wrong action. Later in life, pleasure and pain tell us whether we've actually developed the moral virtues. Since the virtuous take pleasure in performing right action, and the vicious are vexed if they have to do the right thing. Aristotle uses the virtue of self-control to illustrate what he means.
A sign of states of character is provided by the pleasure or pain that follows upon our actions. One who refrains from bodily pleasures and by so doing enjoys what he does is self-controlled. The unbridled person, on the other hand, finds refraining irksome. One who endures fearful things and enjoys it, or at least is not pained by it, is courageous. A coward endures with pain.
Aristotle believes that everyone, especially legislators, would benefit by studying his ethical theory. But he also recognizes that if we're to benefit fully, somehow he has to define the difference between voluntary and involuntary actions. We can be justly rewarded and punished only for what we do voluntarily. For Aristotle, voluntary action can be explained without resorting to some mysterious notion of a free will. He defines a voluntary action by first defining the involuntary action of a moral agent, a moral decision maker. An involuntary action doesn't express the will of the agent, and an involuntary action could happen in either of two ways, according to Aristotle. First, an action's involuntary when the origin is not in the agent, that is, when the action doesn't result from the agent's desires. Second, an action's involuntary when the agent is unaware of the particular circumstances of the action, when the agent fails to grasp one of the circumstances where he forms the desire to act.
The involuntary action is one brought about either by an agent's being forced to act or through the agent's ignorance of one of the particular circumstances of the action. A voluntary act is one whose origin is in the agent when he is aware of the particular circumstances of the action.
Suppose someone shoots his brother, falsely believing that he was shooting a strange intruder. This act would be done in ignorance of a particular circumstance. The agent wouldn't perform the act if he were aware of the true circumstances. Aristotle himself raises what seems to be an obvious problem with his theory of moral development. On the one hand, he recognizes that our upbringing makes, as he says, all the difference in whether or not we develop the moral virtues. On the other hand, he insists that we're responsible for our own character. But how can we be responsible for our character as an adult if our character's the result of our childhood training, something we couldn't control? Aristotle can't claim that we suddenly change as adults. He knows that our characters are gradually formed as we mature. If adult habits can be altered at all, it can only be with great difficulty. Aristotle argues, then, that we are responsible for our character because we voluntarily choose our actions. As he puts it,
"Only a thoroughly senseless person does not know that character results from the repeated performance of the corresponding actions. Moreover, there was a beginning point when it was possible for us not to become the persons we did."
Unfortunately, nowhere does Aristotle tell us just when this beginning point occurs or how the victims of bad childhood training can escape a life of viciousness. Some have said that Aristotle thinks there's a period at the end of childhood when our capacity to reason first emerges. Then it is possible for anyone, even the victim of poor childhood training, to understand that pursuing moral virtue is better than a vicious life. Everyone would be responsible for making the correct choice at this first instance of moral responsibility and afterwards. But if this is what Aristotle means, he never says so explicitly. Nor is it clear that he could reconcile such a claim with his idea that childhood training determines later moral development. At the end of the Nicomachean Ethics, he returns to the question of what is really the best life for man. Quoting his own definition of happiness, he tells us that supreme happiness is contemplation.
"If happiness is the activity of the soul in accordance with virtue, it is reasonable that it is in accordance with the highest virtue. And this must be the excellence of the best part of us. Whether this be the intellect or something else which by nature appears to lead us and to grasp what is noble and divine, whether it is itself divine or is simply the most divine part in us, it must be the activity of this part of us in accordance with its proper virtue that is complete happiness. This activity is the activity of contemplation."
Here Aristotle makes it clear that exercising a perfected intellect, contemplating the timeless philosophical truths, the nature of God, the universe, and man, is vastly to be preferred to time spent performing right action. This is true regardless of how well performed or how noble the cause. But if contemplation is so much better than moral action, why then does Aristotle devote so much time in the Ethics to explaining the various moral virtues and how they're to be acquired? In only one passage does he even appear to hint at his answer to this question.
"A human being will be in need of external well-being. His nature is not self-sufficient for unlimited contemplation, but it is necessary for him to have bodily health, food, and the other requirements."
Here Aristotle denies that man can live a life of unlimited contemplation. Man's capacity to reason is only one part of his human soul, so excellence in contemplation fulfills only part of man's essence. For man is also an animal. Like all animals, to be happy he must fulfill his bodily impulses and desires. But he can only fulfill his unique human potential by expressing the moral virtues in what he does. This unique moral potential is no doubt why Aristotle devotes so much attention in the Ethics to questions of the moral virtues and how they can be attained. As we've seen, he believes the supreme happiness of unlimited contemplation belongs only to God, whose nature consists of pure reason alone. Aristotle believes that human fulfillment can be achieved only by living in a particular kind of political association called a polis. In this independent city-state, such as Athens, all citizens are governed by a common set of laws.
Since we see that every city-state is an association, and every association is established for the sake of some good to be achieved, it is clear that that association that is supreme and embraces all of the others also aims at the supreme good. This association is called a polis, and it is a political association.
Aristotle outlines the various types of cities and how a city should be organized to optimize human fulfillment in an unfinished set of lectures called The Politics. If he's right, human beings naturally live in a city. Indeed, the city itself is a natural phenomenon. As Aristotle's fond of saying, the city exists by nature.
Man is, by nature, a political animal. While one who is unable to enter into political associations, or who, on account of his self-sufficiency, has no need of the city, is either an animal lower than a human, or else is a god.
The basic element of every city-state, he says, is the household, the immediate members of a family, and any slaves they may own. Slavery is justified, according to Aristotle, so long as the slaves are both non-Greeks and what Aristotle calls slaves by nature.
One is by nature a slave if he is capable of being owned by another person, and who shares in reason, insofar as he is able to see it in another, but who does not possess it himself.
Aristotle believes that anyone's better off when his life is guided by reason. He thinks the natural slave can't reason for himself, so he's better off having his life governed by someone else. The same bit of reasoning leads Aristotle to believe that in a well-run household, all important decisions are made by the husband, alone. Children, of course, are not yet able to reason, and although Aristotle thinks women can reason, he says only men abide by their own decisions. So if members of a household are to live as they ought, the women of the household need to follow the commands of an adult Greek male. To understand what sort of city is best, we must first recognize the different kinds of cities. Aristotle says cities are different in terms of what he calls their constitutions.
A constitution is the arrangement of the offices within cities and determines the manner by which they are apportioned, the kind of sovereignty of the city, and the purpose of each association.
Any well-governed city encourages the largest number of citizens to attain virtue. Only then, as we have seen, will they be happy. Furthermore, there are three basic forms of good government which tend to serve this goal, and three which tend to thwart it.
It is necessary that there be a single ruler, or rule by a few, or by a multitude of citizens. In cases in which the one, the few, and the many rule for the sake of the common good, their governments are the right ones. On the other hand, those conducted for the sake of private interest, either of the one, or the few, or the many, are deviations from the right forms of government. We customarily call monarchies ruling for the sake of the common advantage by the designation kingship. The government of a few, but more than one, we call aristocracy. But whenever the multitude governs for the sake of the common advantage, we call that government by the name common to all constitutions, polity. Deviations from those mentioned are tyranny coming from kingship, oligarchy from aristocracy, and democracy from polity. For tyranny is monarchy ruling in the interest of the monarch. Oligarchy rules in the interest of the rich, and democracy rules in the interest of the poor. But none of these exists for the benefit of the community as a whole.
In Aristotelian theory, monarchy and aristocracy are the best forms of government, since both are governments by men of superior virtue. However, polity is the only practical and truly workable form of good government. Aristotle argues that polity alone can practically solve the conflicting interests of the wealthy few and the impoverished many. He's laid down a general rule in the Nicomachean Ethics that the moderate course is always best. So political power in a polity should be directed by the middle class.
In every city, there are three parts: the exceedingly rich, the exceedingly poor, and the third, which occupies a middle position. Since it is agreed that the moderate or the middle is best, it is clear that the middle portion of the gifts of fortune is best. This part is most ready to obey reason, whereas the exceedingly beautiful, or strong, or well-born, or wealthy, or the opposite of these, the exceeding weak and poor, find it difficult to be governed by reason. The former become arrogant and inclined to great evil, whereas the latter are evildoers and mischief makers. Moreover, every injustice comes about through arrogance or petty wickedness.
Aristotle thinks the force of law can discourage the very rich and the very poor from acting on their inclinations to do evil. But he thinks neither the rich nor the poor can ever be fully happy. If he's right, then even in a very well-structured state, the majority of people will never find fulfillment. None of this is to say that the rich and the poor are wholly excluded from political participation in a polity. Indeed, Aristotle believes that excluding whole classes from political participation is the greatest source of internal friction within a state. But if the multitude can join the deliberation about passing laws, for example, what guarantee is there that they'll reason well? After all, throughout the Nicomachean Ethics and the Politics, Aristotle insists that the impoverished multitudes are never superior in virtue. He says that moral wisdom tends to emerge when a group deliberates about a common goal, even if none of the members is either good or wise.
It is possible that the many, although none is individually a good man, when they come together, are better than those who are good. Not as individuals, but collectively, just as public dinners are better when the multitude contributes than when they are supplied by a single person. For where there are many, each has a share of virtue and practical wisdom, and when they have come together, they are as one with respect to moral habits and intelligence.
Aristotle concedes that if either the rich or the poor become too strong, the polity eventually will fail. So for a polity to succeed, everyone must strictly obey laws that promote the common good. Only the rule of law, he thinks, can protect the citizens against individuals and even whole classes who would make themselves tyrants over their fellows.
The person who recommends that the laws rule seems to recommend that intelligence and God rule. But he that recommends that man rule seems to add a beast. For appetite is like a beast, and passion destroys the rule even of the best men.
The laws of the good society must, of course, encourage moral excellence and discourage vice. But they must also distribute political rights and civic honors justly. As Aristotle conceives it, justice doesn't require all citizens to be given precisely the same rights and an equal share in civic honors. The most deserving should be given a greater share of such things in proportion to how much they deserve it. The morally virtuous deserve more because they have, through their noble actions, contributed more to the very purpose of the city, to the well-being of everyone.
A political association must be considered to exist for the sake of noble actions, and not for the sake of mere communal living. Hence, those who contribute most to such an association have a larger share of the city than do those who are their equals with respect to their freedom or birth, but who are not their equals in civic virtue. Those who are greater in moral virtue have a greater share in the city than those who are greater in wealth, but are surpassed in virtue.
But for Aristotle, the city shouldn't merely assign rights and bestow honors. It also should help its citizens acquire virtue. so the education of children should be carefully directed by the city.
Since there is one single end in every city, it is clear that there is of necessity a single end of education for all, and that proper education is a matter of public concern, and is not to be the concern of the individual who, as things now stand, oversees the education of his children in private and teaches them whatever branch of knowledge he believes he should. But it is clear that these laws must be made regarding education, and that public education must be what is carried out.
A city that promotes virtue in its citizens must also control what is seen and heard, especially by the young, so they won't be attracted by the wrong values.
It is necessary that the lawgiver banish completely indecent talk from the city, for the doing of disgraceful things comes about from playful talk. This must be applied most of all among the young, that they may not see or hear anything disgraceful. Moreover, if anyone is seen saying or doing anything that has been prohibited, if he is a free man, he is to be dishonored with a punishment and a beating. And if we banish speech that is disgraceful, it is clear that we must also outlaw seeing pictures and representations that are indecent.
Unlike Plato, however, Aristotle doesn't want to banish all poetry and drama. On the contrary, he believes that seeing well-written tragedies actually benefits the audience because, as he says, it arouses fear and pity and thus achieves a catharsis of such emotions. Presumably, he thinks that over time, emotions like fear and pity build up in people to the point where they become excessive. But excess of any kind invariably leads to wrongdoing unless it finds release. The cathartic effect occurs, first, because the drama presents what the audience believes is possible. Second, the audience is appeased because the central character is presented as someone they would like to be.
The hero must not be extraordinarily righteous and just, whose misfortune is not brought upon him because of vice, but because of some flaw in his character, of the sort that persons of great reputation and prosperity often have.
In seeing the heroic protagonist and the irreversible misfortune he suffers, the audience is reminded that they too are vulnerable to disaster. They too feel fear and pity. They thereby purge these emotions. Aristotle believes excessive emotion is one of the major sources of evil. He also thinks the city will be better off if its citizens are regularly exposed to such dramatic tragedies. Even if everyone, male and female, citizen and slave, is better off living in a city that promotes the common good, only a few can experience true human fulfillment. In his work, The Politics, Aristotle never loses sight of the central doctrine in the Nicomachean Ethics. Fulfillment is achieved by exercising both intellectual and moral virtues. But both require leisure time, first to develop and then to practice. Aristotle says only someone who thinks seriously about philosophy, one who's mastered his theoretical doctrines and puts those doctrines into practice, can truly lay claim to the highest degree of human happiness. Throughout Aristotle's writings, two assumptions are evident. First, he believes that everything that exists in nature is ultimately intelligible to man. By mastering a small number of concepts, for example, form and matter, potentiality and actuality, genus and species, we can come to know what each thing is and how it is related to the rest of nature. Seen through Aristotelian eyes, nature reveals herself to be a great chain of being, stretching from the prime mover, the perfect essence, through man and the lower animals to the most elemental plants. Aristotle assumes also that what is natural is good. Just as a good horse displays the nature of horses, so a good human being displays the nature of man. And since a human being naturally reasons, the good man not only comes to understand the world and his place in it, but he organizes his private and public life so that all may develop their natural potential to the highest degree. Aristotle believes that what's natural is good, and what deviates from nature is evil. So he concludes that he who lives by the animal appetites and cares nothing for the great questions of philosophy will only be a detriment to himself and to society. Such a man leads a life that's unnatural for a human being. For Aristotle says in the first line of his work, The Metaphysics, all men by nature desire to know.
We hope you have enjoyed this presentation of Aristotle by Knowledge Products. The script for this presentation is by Thomas C. Brickhouse, Professor of Philosophy, Lynchburg College. The script is edited by Professor John Locks of Vanderbilt University and Mike Hassel of Knowledge Products. Produced by Pat Childs. Vocal characterizations are by Rob Daniel, Travis Hardison, Cecil Jones, Joe Keenan, Paul Meyer, Dieter Seven, and Robert Wynn. Music is by Ralph Childs. Recorded at Fred Jones Recording Services and Archer Productions. This material may not be copied in whole or in part without the written permission of the copyright owner. Copyright 1990 by Carmichael & Carmichael Incorporated. This presentation of The Giants of Philosophy is a part of the Audio Classics series, a continuing series of cassettes presenting the major ideas of great thinkers with a discussion of their historical and intellectual context.